Taking an expectant mother? What, feel solidarity with a crab? Said Nayeli. Yola was always simmering with revolutionary theories. In a way, she's our sister, Yola insisted. This was the trouble with straight-A students. They thought up positions and then thought up 1,000 insane defenses for their instant policies. This crab is not my sister, Yolo. She is my lunch. Nayeli tried to think of a pregnant woman in Tres Camarones. She's no sister of mine. I'm not pregnant. This crab might be the sister of... She started to say... No sé quién. Who's pregnant? Yolo snorted. She loved her ridiculous debates with Nayeli. They could talk in loops for hours on the merits of rock and español versus reggaeton, or on the merits of football versus baseball. They left poor Vampi suicidal with boredom when they got on their little jags. Crab! Nayeli shouted, pointing. This time Yolo beat her. She plunged under and worked her stick. It was a small male, but a small crab was still a tasty crab. That's a dozen, Nayeli said. Let's take them to Tacho. Let's eat. In her atrocious English, Nayeli said, Oh, yeah, baby. As they waded to shore, she said, But who's pregnant? Seriously. I can't think of anybody. Yolo thought. They came out of the water, each of them holding a handle of the basket. Yolo shrugged. I can't think of anybody either, she said. They squatted and gobbled their crabs, the women and Tacho. The shrimpers and boys sat at the far end of the lagoon, eating beans wrapped in tortillas and minding their own business. Occasionally, Tacho whistled, and one of the boys came running to open beer bottles and bring more crabs from the aromatic pot. La Osa made Tacho surrender 3 fat crabs to the boys so they could eat some, too. La Osa reminded herself of Benito Juarez at moments like that. She basked in affection for herself. Nayeli waited for an opportune moment to ask the ladies, Who's pregnant? Not me, said Tacho. They threw napkins and crab claws at him. Do you mean among us here? La Osa said, patting her gut. Because it's a little late for my comrades and me. The older women chuckled. You'd better not be trying to tell us anything, she warned. You'd better not. She shook a crab leg at Nayeli. La Osa drank another beer. Tacho hustled to fetch a fresh one and fished out a 7-Up for himself. 7 Up, he announced. Why do you ask? Aunt Irma finally said. When was Tres Camarones ever without babies? Nayeli asked. What an odd thing. Excuse me, girlfriends, Tacho interrupted. You need men to make babies. The old women nodded. What? Nayeli said. Men, said Tacho. What are you talking about, Machito? Men. Didn't you notice? Notice what? All the men are gone. Ridiculous. Oh, really? Jesus, Irma announced. Is there anyone sillier than a teenage girl? The women and Tacho laughed out loud. The girlfriends sat there glowering. They couldn't stand being called silly. All teenage girls ever notice, Irma said, is their own little dramas. They're idiots. She used the graphic word babosadas, which denoted drool running down their chins, but also suggested they were as stupid as babosos, slugs. The girls were outraged. Are not, they cried. The women shook their heads. All gone, Irma said, making a puff with her lips. Blown away, off to the beautiful north. She took a swig of beer. Welcome to the real world, children. Nayeli stared at Yolo with her mouth hanging open. All she could think was, I'll show you who's stupid. Irma stood. She smacked the sand off her legs. I have one word for the men, she said as she stomped away. Traitors. Nobody wanted to go home after their day at the beach, so they gathered at Tia Irma's house on the corner of 22 de Diciembre and Morelos Streets to watch her color television. La Osa set the TV in the window, facing the street, and the guests all hauled chairs out onto the cobbles so they could feel the breeze. They watched a telenovela featuring savage love among hacienda owners in Brazil. Then they watched a telenovela that featured savage love among cattle ranchers in Durango. It grew dark. Cicadas knocked themselves senseless against the television screen. Bats twirled above them like leaves flying in a windstorm. Passers-by called, Adios! And all the watchers politely called back, Adios! When a car came down the street, they all rose and moved their chairs up onto the curb so the car could pass. They didn't notice that one of the cars was the big narco LTD. Adios, they called, then moved their chairs back into the narrow street. Nayeli watched everybody on the curbs. She looked very carefully, and she realized Tacho was right. There was nobody left in town but women, old men, and little children. Adios. Chapter 5. Although the Mexican government didn't seem to know where Tres Camarones was, its citizens knew in their hearts that they were Sinaloans. They listened to Sinaloan radio from XEHW in Rosario. They did their shopping in Villa Union. And when they went to the big city, as Irma and the girlfriends had done this morning, it was the long jaunt by dirt track and two-lane highway to Mazatlan. Irma had maneuvered her apocalyptic 1959 Cadillac through the murky verdure surrounding Tres Camarones and had hit the main road by 9 a.m. The notorious girlfriends had snored and snuffled in the big back seat as she drove. Vampi had not been allowed to wear black clothes or black makeup, so she had miserably reported to Irma's house clad in an orange jumper. Así se vista una señorita, La Osa had enthused, brusquely turning her back and forth and grabbing her chin to inspect her freshly scrubbed face. She approved. This was the way young ladies dressed. You're not even half ugly, she had added. They'd cut through the great green lowlands. White birds exploded from the fields. The highway to the Durango Mountains whipped by, and Irma told them for the 100th time that there were waterfalls up there, and one day, when she wasn't so busy, she'd drive them up there for some roasted goat. They'd love the waterfalls, very fresh and chilly. I went there once, she intoned, with Chava Chavarin. Who? Vampi said. The girlfriends no longer listened to these empty promises. They nodded off to the relentless hum and rattle of the caddy. Irma barely saw the oldest cowboy in Mexico trotting along the road on his ancient pony. He lifted his hat to her. She waved with one finger. Irma lit a cigarette, jabbed on the radio, and heard Agustin Lara. Ah, real music. Not this idiotic ass-twitching noise the girlfriends listened to. Or worse, That Norteño crap with the accordions, rube music for cocaine smugglers. La Osa tipped down the rearview mirror and checked her teeth for lipstick and tobacco shreds. She watched the girlfriends leaning against each other's shoulders, sleeping with their mouths open. "My black-eyed girls," she said. Tia Irma turned to the vegetable seller in his booth and said, "What the hell is happening to these beans?" "Excuse me?" he said, pausing in his inventory, holding the stub of a pencil above the wilting pink pages of an order pad. "There is something happening to my beans? How dare you charge so much for beans?" "Charge?" he said. He looked at the hand-lettered tag he'd magic-markered onto a fragment of manila folder 2 days ago. "No," he said, "this is the rate." "Es una infamia," she said. "Es un robo." "No, no, señora," he said, not knowing he'd just made her even angrier because she'd never been married and didn't intend to have the slave's moniker of Mrs. applied to her under any circumstances. "This is the correct price." "First tortillas," she complained. "Now this. What's next? Water? Will you charge us for water? Ha! What are the poor people supposed to eat?" He looked at her with wide eyes and shrugged. "The poor?" he said. The poor did not shop at the fruit market. They sold lizards and birds and corn husk dolls on the highway. They ate armadillos. He didn't have time for the poor. Beyond the fruit market rose the green Mazatlan hills and the white cliffs of the gringo tourist hotels. They could hear joyous voices and splashing from the hotel pools. They could smell the salt of the sea among the odors of cut sugarcane and fish and crushed mangoes and oranges. Music and radios and trumpets and whistling and laughter and shouts and truck engines and some idiot's La Cucaracha car horn. Seagulls fighting over pieces of bread. Oyster shells. "Forget the poor," Irma shouted. "What about the good working people of Mexico?"
"Go, tía," Nayeli said.
"We are Mexicans," Irma informed the fruit seller. Needlessly, he felt. "Mexicans eat corn and beans. Did you notice? The Aztec culture gave corn to the world, you little man. We invented it. Mexicans grow beans. How is it, then, that Mexicans cannot afford to buy and eat the corn and beans they grow?" He would have kicked her out of his stall, but he had manners. His mother would have been deeply offended if he had tossed out this old battle axe. He smiled falsely. "Look here," he said, pointing to the burlap sacks full of 100 pounds each of pinto beans. "These beans come from California."
"What?"
He actually flinched away from her. La Osa took her reading glasses out of her voluminous black purse, and the girls crowded around her. They read the fine print. California, all right. Right there on the bag.
"Chingao," she said.
"These beans are grown here in Sinaloa," he said proudly. "The best frijoles in the world, right near Culiacan. Then they're sold to the United States. Then they sell them back to us."
He shrugged at the mysterious ways of the world.
"It gets expensive."
Tia Irma took a long time to replace the glasses in the purse.
"That," she finally proclaimed, "is the stupidest thing anyone has ever said to me."
He smiled, hoping she would not strike him with that purse.
"NAFTA," he said.
Irma stormed out of the stall and spied a Guatemalan woman picking through the spoiled fruit.
"What are you doing?" she snapped.
"Provisions for the journey north," the woman replied.
She made the mistake of extending her hand and saying,
"I have come so far, but I have so far to go. Alms, senora, have mercy."
"Go back where you came from," Irma bellowed. "Mexico is for Mexicans."
The girlfriends were appalled.
"Do you think anyone ever showed mercy to me?"
As the girlfriends followed Aunt Irma, she told them,
"These illegals come to Mexico expecting a free ride. Don't tell me you didn't have Salvadorans and Hondurans in your school, getting the best education in the world. They take our jobs, too,"
she muttered on in her own steamy cloud of indignation. They tuned her out as they marched to the candy cellars.
"What we need is a wall on our southern border.
At least," she continued, "the goopy sweet potato and cactus and guava and dulce de leche Mexican candies were made by Mexicans in Mexico and could still be bought by Mexicans in Mexico." Irma bought mesh bags full of onions, garlic, potatoes. She bought a kilo of dribbly white goat cheese. She scoffed at the coconut milk sellers with their straws poked in cold coconuts. If she wanted a goddamned coconut, she'd hire Tacho to climb a tree. She purchased some candies and melons and limp bunches of cilantro. To hell with Mazatlan's tortillas. Tia Irma would buy good, hot, fresh tortillas right in Camarones, patted into being by the trusted hands of her comadre, Doña Petra. These damned city slickers used machines to press out tortillas anyway. Ha! Robot food.
"Can I drive?" Nayeli asked when they had reached the car.
"Oh, God," Tia Irma grumbled.
But she gave her the keys.
"I'm lonely, Tia," Nayeli announced.
Yolo and Vero were asleep again. The she-bear scoffed.
"Lonely?" she said. "How can you be lonely with good friends and a good book to read?"
"That's Yolo," Nayeli said. "She's the reader."
She passed a lopsided Ford truck overloaded with cucumbers.
"Blinker," Irma reminded her.
Cucumbers fell from the truck like small green bombs, and the Cadillac slid a little on them as she changed lanes. For a moment, the road smelled like a fresh salad.
"Who will touch my face?" Nayeli asked.
Three children chased white chickens before a small house with an open door.
"Who will bring me flowers?"
Tia Irma responded.
"I want to see the lights of a city at night."
"Mazatlan," La Osa patiently lectured, "is a major city, my dear."
"I've never seen it at night. Only by day. Only to buy groceries."
"Oh," said Irma.
"Did no one sing you a serenade when you were young?" asked Nayeli.
"Of course," Irma replied. "I was gorgeous as hell."
"Did no one say dashing things to you on the plazuela on Saturday night?"
Tia Irma smiled.
"Well," she said, "I suppose El Güero Astengo was quite dapper. But it was Chavarin, Chava the Magnificent. Well, that was the definition of dashing."
She trailed off, stared out the window. Nayeli thought she heard the impossible. Irma sighed.
"Who will do that for me?" Nayeli asked. "There are no serenades in Camarones. Who will dance with me?"
Irma could not answer her. Chapter 6. The election was mere days away. Some of the women, it must be said, had not yet accepted the idea that a woman could be municipal president. They had been told that they were moody and flighty and illogical and incapable for so long that they had believed these things. It took much cajoling and cursing on Irma's part to shock them out of their ruts. Nayeli was a driving force among the young of the village, all 20 of them. 9 of the youngsters could vote, and all of these girls were voting for Irma. Those ineligible signed as best they could a statement pledging moral support for Irma's candidacy, and promised to argue the case to their mothers and grandmothers. As for Irma, she had an argument of her own. The legendary Garcia Garcia, owner of the theater, Aunt Irma's distant cousin, and the sole rich man of the town, had spent days on the telephone, fighting bad connections and tropical ennui, calling to far Culiacan and Los Mochis, even all the way to Tecuala, searching for a fresh projectionist, his last one having departed to Michigan to pick apples. Apparently, the trade was a dying concern, and he could find no available takers, so Garcia Garcia himself was forced to suffer in the sauna-hot booth, tying a rag around his head to keep the sweat out of his eyes and stuffing toilet paper into his ears so the rattling whine of the machines didn't make him deaf. At the age of 65, Garcia Garcia was feeling spent, tired, and he was so worried about money that he had his wife shut off the air conditioning unit in his cement block home across the town square from the theater. She was so appalled by this descent into barbarity that she took his Impala and drove herself to Mazatlan to stay with her cousin. The Cine Pedro Infante took the place of television for most people in town, so it was Garcia Garcia's endless challenge to maintain a steady flow of double features. He couldn't afford to let a movie run for a week. In 2 days' time, everyone who could pay to see it would have passed through his doors. The movies were an essential lure, so he could collect inflated prices for beer, soda, and ham and chile tortas in the little stand behind the screen. So what if it turned out the films were of poor quality, whole reels mysteriously spliced out, Chinese subtitles, cat-scratched frames, and underwater soundtracks? A fresh set of titles on the theater marquee meant a lucrative night at the torta stand. Garcia Garcia had a big white house at the end of Avenida Bernal Díaz del Castillo, and its tall metal door, also painted white, boomed like thunder as Irma pounded on it. La Osa fingered a lock of hair behind Nayeli's ear. "Posture," she said. Nayeli stood up straighter. The cinema was visible down the way and across the street, dark and melancholy as a haunted house, its steel shutters down and padlocked. One of Garcia's 5 housekeepers answered the door. "Yes," she said. "I am here to see El Señor," said Irma.
"One moment."
She slammed the door. The door opened.
"He will see you now."
"Gracias." Irma swept in and tipped her head slightly to the young woman, who then looked up and down Nayeli's body, judging her and finding her lacking. Irma stepped in and Nayeli followed, and they were at Garcia Garcia's desk. "Ah," he said, putting his cigarette in an ashtray. "My cousin, the champion." "We are tired of this shit," Irma informed him. Nayeli wasn't sure what was happening. For a moment, she believed Irma was talking about the missing men. "What shit is that, Irma?" Garcia Garcia asked. His Spanish made even that inane comment sound elegant.
A cual mierda te refieres, Irma?
Movies, she explained.
Movies?
Movies.
Ah, movies.
He spread his hands and leaned back in his chair. Nayeli noticed he had very important-looking papers scattered on his desk. Behind his chair, there was a French poster for the movie Bullet, a Steve McQueen with a face like a monkey.
I am here with my campaign manager, Nayeli Cervantes.
His eyebrows went up.
Campaign manager, he replied, leaning forward and offering his hand. It is an honor to meet you, Nayeli.
Sir?
Am I your uncle?
Perhaps.
I must add you to my Christmas list in that case.
She shook his hand and smiled. She was always smiling. His eyes dropped to her chest, fluttered there as nervously as a moth. His eyes sparkled brightly when he looked back up at her. He tugged her hand a little, and for a brief moment she thought he'd pull her over the desk.
Oh, no, she thought. Eso sí que no. That absolutely won't happen.
Mucho gusto, señor, she said, getting her hand back.
Smiley girl, he said to Aunt Irma. She is a karateka, La Osa replied. Nayeli could karate kick you to death where you sit.
That's hardly feminine, he sniffed.
Perhaps, Nayeli suggested, it is time for a new kind of femininity.
La Osa beamed. That's my girl. After the election, Irma warned, I will expect certain employment opportunities for the women of this town.
Employment, he snickered.
He laughed out loud. They didn't.
I already hire women, Garcia Garcia offered lamely. Women sell sandwiches and popcorn, Irma said. Women take tickets and mop out your toilets, but that's not where the real money is.
Well, Garcia Garcia explained, the real money goes to management, to the projectionist.
Irma nodded, smiling benevolently.
No, wait, Garcia Garcia said. You wait, she replied.
You must be kidding.
You must be kidding. Get out, he cried. You get out. This is my house. This is my city.
Nayeli was thrilled. Politics in action.
Irma said, It could be good for you when I'm in power.
Garcia Garcia took a meditative puff of his cigarette.
What does this problem have to do with me? We demand, at the very least, a good job as projectionist.
I am the projectionist, he said.
Train a woman.
He stared at her. Aunt Irma leaned over the desk and said,
Don't be an idiot.
Excuse me, he cried.
Someday I will be president, Irma said. It would be wise for you to get with our program and attend to the needs of the women who now rule this municipality.
She audaciously grabbed his pack of cigarettes and shook one out for herself and then posed, waiting for him to light it.
Es la Betty Davis, Nayeli thought, having seen this very scene on Irma's television.
Garcia Garcia lit the cigarette.
Irma said, Do you want to make money or not? Do you wish to benefit from good relations with City Hall?
The great man stared over their heads, calculating. He smoked and thought. He slowly nodded. It was all over in short order.
Irma had already spoken to Nayeli's mother, and she was ready to be trained for the job of projectionist of the Pedro Infante. Nayeli watched, amazed, as the two negotiators shook hands.
"One last thing," Irma said. "As a favor to me."
"Name it, champion."
"I would like to see the cinema reborn with a film festival of my favorite Mexican superstar."
"Oh, no," Garcia Garcia said, raising his hands as if to deflect a blow.
"This is non-negotiable. I need the inspiration in these trying times of seeing Mexico's greatest film star, Yul Brynner."
"I have told you 100 times that Yul Brynner is not a Mexican," Garcia Garcia cried.
"Are you crazy?" Irma snapped. "I was the bowling champion. I bowled in Mexicali. I bowled in Puerto Vallarta. And I saw his house right there in the jungle, on a hill. Es Mexicano, Yul Brynner?"
"No, no, no.
Besides," Irma announced, "I saw Taras Bulba, and Yul Brynner spoke perfect Spanish."
Garcia Garcia shook his head.
"It was dubbed." "Don't be ridiculous," Irma said. "Come, Nayeli," she snapped.
Garcia Garcia stared at Nayeli.
"She's impossible," he said. "I am counting on you," Irma called.
Nayeli waved her fingers at him and walked out. Election day dawned brightly. No clouds in the sky at all. Everyone voted, even Garcia Garcia. He shoved his ballot marked in favor of Ernesto James, the old mayor, into the box with manly force, then strode out, lit cigar in his mouth, showing his determination before mounting his bike to wobble home. Election monitors from Esquinapa manned the booths in the Secu Carlos Hubbard School Assembly Hall. Tacho cooked free ham tortas for all voters, and Nayeli busied herself running sodas to all the eaters. Tacho, no fool, put extra chipotle salsa on the ham and charged elevated prices for the cold drinks. The fallen hand made a killing. It was a parade. Maria, the projectionist in training, accepted a round of applause when she swept into the polling place. Sensei Gray wore his fedora. Aunt Irma voted for herself. Tacho took a quick break from his grill to vote, then spelled Nayeli so she could do her civic duty. Yolo Xochitl and La Vampira slouched in, acting bored. Tacho kept his eye on two outside agitators, El Guasas and El Pato, who lurked behind the whitewashed trees in the square. The ubiquitous Narco LTD oozed past, followed by a black Cherokee with darkened windows. It was all over by 10 o'clock. The ballots were counted in La Mano Calda. As predicted, Aunt Irma won by a landslide. Outgoing mayor Ernesto James noted darkly to Garcia Garcia that it was women who counted the ballots, but there were not enough men to enforce a recount. Despairing, he looked at the female rabble gathered in the square and threw up his hands. Aunt Irma took the podium in the plaza and announced,
"What did I tell you?"
Firecrackers, bottle rockets, free burro rides for the children. A 98-year-old soldier from the last battle of the Revolution broke out a bugle and skronked like a dying elephant. Tacho turned up his stereo really loud and played records by El Tri and Café Tacuba. Irma, the conquering heroine of Tres Camarones, threw her arm around Nayeli's shoulders. She said, "A new age dawns!"
Chapter 7 Night. Mommy was asleep. Nayeli could hear her soft, whistling snores coming from her room. Poor Vampi, Nayeli thought. She was an orphan. Her parents had died in one of those events Nayeli thought of as somehow especially Mexican. They had gone south, instead of north, seeking work in Jalisco. Their bus driver had fallen asleep, and the bus had plunged off a cliff, killing all the passengers. The driver had survived. Vampi's grandmother had raised her. No mother or father in Tres Camarones would have allowed her to get away with her goth outfits. But a tired grandmother could not hope to contain her. Nayeli wandered through her mother's small house in the dark. The sideboard that held her father's picture was always lit with a few votive candles standing on saucers, Doña Maria's small altar to Don Pepe. Nayeli used the hem of her blouse to dust the standing picture frame. Her father looked so handsome in his police uniform, erect and grim. He believed no real man ever smiled in photographs, especially not in uniform. After all, aside from the mayor, Don Pepe was the sole representative of the revolutionary government of the Republic. A man's man. But also a leader among men. He used to take her down to the Baluarte River to shoot his .38. She smiled. He'd set up soda bottles, and she'd shoot 6 rounds at a time and miss the bottles with every shot. He never said he wished he'd had a son, though she could tell he thought it often. He'd park his police car beside the soccer field, and when she scored a goal, he'd set off the siren, sorely frightening the mothers in the stands. But he could not make enough money to take care of them. He earned the equivalent of $20 American a week, and he had to buy his own pistol and bullets. On the day he left, there was wailing and breastbeating. He held Nayeli for a moment. She could smell his aftershave and his shaving cream and his deodorant and his breath mints, and he... The bus. The empty street. She shook her head. Don Pepe had been philosophical. He had always offered her nuggets of wisdom that he would have given his son if only he had been so blessed. And the short girl he called La Chaparra was a good kid and had listened intently to his insights. So, when he told Nayeli, "The more I learn, the less I know," she pondered it. He was a big reader, and he informed her once that all water that ever existed remained in its original form. "You drink the same water that Jesus Christ washed his feet in," Don Pepe lectured. "Cleopatra once took a bath in your ice cube." His favorite saying, because it was concise, was, "Everything passes." He had written this gnomic prophecy on his postcard from Kankakee, Illinois, with its luridly colored picture of a mentally ill wild turkey in cornfield. "Mi dear Chaparra, things go well here. Good boys at work. I will send funds soon. I have much luck, but everything passes. Your father, Pepe." Don Pepe was a Mexican man, a fatalist. He meant to impart much more than comfort. He meant that all good things would also end. All joy would crumble. And death would visit each and every one of them. He meant that regimes and ancient orders and cultures would all collapse. The world as we know it becomes a new world overnight. The announcements were already going out. The Cine Pedro Infante was back in the film festival business.
Maria Cervantes had taken her projectionist exams at the hand of Garcia Garcia and had passed. He had put in his orders for the first films, and though it felt corrupt, he had caved in to Aunt Irma's City Hall pressure and brought in Yul Brynner movies. Of course, Garcia Garcia was Mexico's number one Steve McQueen fan. Indeed, he would have shown Baby the Rain Must Fall every week if he could have. Still, was not politics the art of compromise? To be sure, Irma was now mayor, and crossing her an extremely unwise strategy. And yet, Garcia Garcia had some things going for himself, too. He was a cineiste. He knew of Orson Welles and Bela Lugosi and Zeppo Marx, and he knew there were ways to insert a Steve McQueen in a Yul Brynner film fest. There was one movie, just one, that featured both of them.
Ese cuate si es todo un hombre, he announced to his housekeepers as he studied the McQueen poster on his wall.
Yes, they agreed. That dude was 100% a man. For the other film of his planned double feature, Garcia Garcia was faced with a choice between The King and I and Westworld. He chose to keep the Western theme as pure as possible and went for the killer cowboy robot thriller. The movie office had promised him that both films were subtitled, not dubbed. They would hear the real voices, well, German dubbed, of the actors. He would show Aunt Irma once and for all that Yul Brynner was not a Mexican from Puerto Vallarta. The robot movie would play first. Second would come the great team-up, Brynner and McQueen. Second would come the Magnificent Seven. Many of the tropical movie houses had no roofs. Inside, they featured covered galleries along the walls, and when it started to rain, the moviegoers stood under the eaves and kept watching the films until the weather passed. The cheap theater in Culiacán was known as Las Pulgas, because it was so filthy you could get fleas from going there. But Garcia Garcia had put a corrugated tin roof over his beloved Pedro Infante, leaving open only the last 4 feet between the tops of the cinder block walls and the angled roof, lest the overwhelming body heat condense on the tin and drop on the audience in a small, salty squall. It was true that, when the catastrophic summer rains hit every June 6th, the racket was so loud that the soundtrack couldn't be heard, but those within remained dry. And really, with subtitles, only the most spoiled moviegoer would claim to have lost the narrative thread. Inside, the seats were metal, and the joke was that everybody who went to the Pedro Infante was a wetback, because the seat backs made everyone sweat. In fact, the seats were all rusted red from years of back sweat. At either side of the screen stood two huge revolving fans. The blasts of fetid air these fans shot at the crowd occasionally knocked the bats from their roosts on the ceiling, and they fell, fluttering wildly over the heads of the people. Old-timers kept a handy newspaper or cardboard fan at their seats so they could shoo the winged rodents away, which they did, without ever taking their eyes off Cantiflas or John Wayne. The house was filling fast. Nayeli, Tacho on her arm, paid her respects to Father Francois, as ever in the front row.
"When are you coming to church?" he asked Tacho.
"Por Dios," Tacho said. "We would all be hit by lightning." La Vampi was hanging out with two girls from the Secundaria Carlos Hubbard.
¿Qué onda, mora? Vampi called.
Orale, rucas de la secu, Carlitos,
Nayeli shouted back. Yola Xochitl was with her mother and her grandmother. There was Garcia Garcia, sitting with four of his five females. The shrimpers from the crabbing day at the lagoon had come with their wives. Tiki Ledon sat with her mother, one of Chava Chavarin's conquests, the vivacious Doña Laura. Tia Irma studiously ignored her. After 40 years, she remained an arch-rival. Everybody was there, even Peppino, the town simpleton, who seemed to be selling sodas on a tray. Nayeli and Tacho took a seat behind La Osa, who turned around and warned, "Don't be saying stupid things while I'm watching my movie." She turned back around and lit a cigarette. "What's her problem?" Tacho asked. Irma snapped without looking back. "What did I tell you, cabron?" "The movie didn't even start yet," Tacho bleated. Nayeli signaled Peppino and bought each of them a soda.
"Nayeli," Peppino giggled. "Merry Peppino."
"Maybe tomorrow," she replied.
Ay,
he enthused, then stumbled down the steps to deliver a coca to Father Francois. Nayeli leaned against Tacho's arm.
"I hate Yul Brynner," she whispered.
"I know," Tacho whispered back. "Viejo feo." The lights went down. Uproar. Much clapping. Nayeli knew how to stick two fingers in her mouth and blow, unleashing a wail as loud as a passing train whistle. Garcia Garcia had a treat for them. Cartoons! He sat back and laughed out loud at the roadrunner. The laughter was so loud that the startled bats launched from their perches and did a quick strafing run above the crowd. Aunt Irma simply set her lighter on high and blasted 2 feet of flame over her head. Westworld. The title in Spanish was Robot Terror of the Psychopathic Bandito. Nayeli groaned. Tacho whispered,
"I've seen this one on TV. They have sex robots."
Irma turned and glared at him.
"Sorry," he said.
Nayeli and Tacho giggled when Aunt Irma's silhouette clearly fidgeted every time Yul, El Mexicano, Brynner, walked on stage. She turned at one point and said, "Do you hear that accent? You can hardly tell he's Mexican." Nayeli snorted. It was over quickly enough. La Osa was obviously displeased that Yul had been shot down and had his face blown away by the gringo bastards in the movie. She was thinking, "I would buy that robot." Intermission. Nayeli abandoned Tacho and made the rounds of all her girlies. They lounged and slumped in the aisles. A cumbia band, hired by Garcia Garcia, entered the theater and revved up another mindless vamp about a handsome black-skinned girl whose dancing broke the bones of all the men watching her. The chorus was, "Caliente! La negra está caliente!" During the intermission, Father Francois told Nayeli, "Of course you know that the Magnificent Seven is based on Kurosawa's classic sword-fighting epic, The Seven Samurai." Hearing epic, epopeya, Yolo quipped, "Oh, Papa is in it?" Angry, Father Francois continued, "The villagers are beset upon by bandidos. Overwhelmed and outgunned, they revert to a desperate plan. They go to Los Unaites and work at Burger King," Yolo blurted. Father Francois returned to his seat. If he couldn't teach these idiots catechism, what made him think they could be taught about world cinema? Nayeli followed him.
"I'm listening, Padre. Ignore them."
He huffed. "As I was saying, they send a group of brave peasants north to Los Unaites." He cast an evil eye at Yolo and her homegirls.
"What do they find there?" Nayeli asked.
"They find 7 gunmen. The Magnificent 7, you see? 7 killers that they bring back from the border to fight for them."
In spite of herself, Nayeli felt tingles.
"Chido," she said.
She hurried back to her seat to whisper to Tacho. When that music started, she got tingles again. The insanely picturesque color, the gigantic landscapes, even the pathetic Mexican village and the chubby gringo bad guy making believe he was a Mexican bandido, she loved it all.
Tacho yawned. "I want to see a car chase," he said. Irma,
"Shh." "I don't like horses," Tacho added.
Irma,
"Shh."
When Yul Brynner strode into the picture, wearing the same outfit he'd worn as the killer cowboy robot in Westworld, Nayeli nudged Tacho.
"Oh my God," he said. "Can't he afford new clothes?"
Aunt Irma growled. They laughed behind their hands. Suddenly, there was Steve McQueen.
"He has a stupid little cowboy hat," Tacho noted, marking McQueen a few points down on his mental fashion scorecard.
Garcia kept his enthusiasm in check as long as he could. But when Mr. McQueen shot a bunch of bad guys out of windows, while Yul Brynner merely drove the wagon they were riding in, he could no longer stay silent.
"Era más macho. Ese pinche McQueen."
That was what Tres Camarones needed. Real men doing manly things like shooting sons of bitches out of windows. He let out a yell.
"Viva Steve McQueen!"
Irma could not believe this.
"Viva Yul Brynner!" she hollered back. "Steve! Yul!"
All around them, people were shushing them. Tacho noted,
"I thought you wanted quiet."
"Be quiet yourself, you fool. Viva Yul!" Someone threw a wadded paper cup at Aunt Irma, and she piped down with some grumbling. She was furious. She could see Garcia down there, turning to his seatmates and explaining the many wonders of Steve McQueen. And McQueen wasn't even a Mexican.
Nayeli sat with her mouth open. Tacho was snoring softly beside her. She looked down into the theater and saw Yolo and her family calmly watching. Didn't anybody else feel the electric charge she felt? She watched the rest of the movie in a daze. She hardly saw what happened on the screen. She had already sunk deeply into her own thoughts. When the lights came up, and the people clapped, and Yolo whistled, and Tacho snorted awake, and Garcia stood and accepted all the kudos, Nayeli remained in her seat.
"Mija," Tacho said, "I'm tired. I'm going home."
He air-kissed her cheek, but she didn't notice it. Nayeli pulled her father's postcard from her sock and studied it. A cornfield with an impossibly blue sky, an American sky. She had seen it over and over again in the movie. Only American skies, apparently, were so stunningly blue. She turned the card over. It said, "A typical corn crop in Kankakee, Illinois." She more or less understood the message. "Una cosecha típica," she told herself. Don Pepe had written, "Everything passes." She rose slowly and drifted out the door. Yolo and La Vampira were waiting outside.
"¿Qué te pasa?" La Vampi asked.
Yolo said, "Are you all right, chica?" Nayeli waved them off.
"Hey," said Yolo, "we're talking to you."
Nayeli gestured for them to follow her, and walked to the town square. She absent-mindedly swept off a bench and sat down. Her homegirls sat on either side of her. She held up a finger for quiet while she thought some more. She finally said, "The Magnificent Seven." They stared at her. "So?" said Yolo.
"Boring," said Vampi.
"The Seven," Nayeli repeated. "What about them?" Yolo said.
"We have to go get them," Nayeli said. "We have to go to Los Unaites and get the Seven."
"Qué?" Vampi cried. "Steve McQueen?"
"No, Mensa," Yolo snapped. "He's dead."
"We have to stop the bandits before they come and destroy the village. Don't you see? They're coming."
"So," said Vampi.
"Who is going to fight them?" Nayeli asked.
Yolo dug her toe into the ground.
"Cops," she said.
"What cops?" Nayeli asked.
Yolo shrugged one shoulder.
"I guess your dad would have."
They sat there.
"We go," Nayeli said. "We find seven men who want to come home, but they have to be... what?"
"Soldiers," Yolo suggested.
"Right. We interview men. Only cops or soldiers can come."
Vampi held up a finger.
"Perdón," she said. "Where are we going again?"
"Los Unaites," Yolo said.
"What? Are you kidding?"
"We're not kidding," Nayeli said.
"Oh, great," Vampi complained. "There goes my week."
"We have a mission," Nayeli said. "We're only going there to bring the men back home."
Vampi said, "Maybe you can find your father."
Nayeli looked at her. She sat back down.
"What about my father?" Yolo demanded.
Vampi replied, "He's not a cop." They sat there, stunned by the enormity of Nayeli's plan.
"We will only be there for as long as it takes us to get the men to come," she continued. "The Americanos will be happy we're there, even if we're caught."
"You're crazy," Yolo said.
"Dances?"